Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode 391. That's right, 391 episodes, all for you guys, available anytime. Head on over to WCYpodcast.com to check all of that out and more. This week on the program, I've got a lengthy paper that explores a lot of the ancient mystery religions and their relation to Freemasonry, which we know through archaeological studies and mythological studies and the basis of how this is all put together, there are lots of connections. Of course, you've heard me talk about the Dionysian rites, the Eleusinians, Zagreus, all of the iterations of those mysteries, but this particular paper, which I will be reading for the first time, so after the paper, real reaction, I won't read it ahead of time. In addition to that paper, we've also got a great interview with Brother Joe Martinez, who, as you all know, was on the Masonic Roundtable not long ago, and also is one of the founders of the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon. So we've got him on the program to talk a little bit about that. And we've also got illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison on the program. Don't go anywhere. We'll get right into all that in just a moment. All right, something I need to talk about very quickly is, of course, Skull and Crown Limited. We've run into a few snags. You can check out all of the updates and progress on production of our flagship product, which I did announce, which is a leather wrap for a journal with our exclusive logo on it. We're planning on doing just a limited run, hence limited in the most literal sense of the word. Probably 33 of them, a limited run, maybe 10 t-shirts will go out to pre-sale order people. We're still securing some distribution contracts with some major names in stationery. Moleskine, Staedtler, those guys, we're counting on trying to get something going with them so that we can offer the best price for those things. But that's that. We're also going to be launching a line of, well, I say toss away, but I don't know anybody who tosses journals away, non-refillable journals, which are going to be much more casual. They're not anything that you're going to break the bank on. We're going to offer those too. You may have seen some of the posts on those. There's offered, I have a red, which comes in a gold or a silver. That's the Regal. We've also got the Academic, which is a green and gold, and it's like a faux snake skin. The paper is okay. It's not meant to be the best stuff in the world. It's meant to be just a note, a small note journal that you can toss in your bag and not really worry about it. Paper is good. Ink bleeds into that paper. It's not the kind of paper where the ink dries on the paper, so it sucks it in. So for that, I would not recommend your fountain pens. I wouldn't recommend that kind of thing. I would probably stick with fine ballpoint or pencil work within these journals, just so we're on the level about it. My thanks goes out to everybody out there who has bought pins over the last couple weeks. I just shipped out a bunch. I want to thank everybody out there buying those producer pins. If you are curious what I'm talking about, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Limited Edition Shop, and when you go there, you're going to see the all-new pin. We've got the Mason's Lady decal, and of course, I've got a few copies of It's Business Time, Adapting a Corporate Path for Masonry, downstairs in my secretary, and I'm ready to sign those and ship them out to you. Thank you to everybody out there doing that. In addition, we've got our direct donations through PayPal. You can make a one-time donation, or you can even sign up to be a monthly contributor. So we've got the $2 a month contributor, the fellow, which is $5 a month, and the producer, which is $10 a month. And those are just direct ACH debits from you to the podcast account, and that is where all of our bills get paid from. So it's wonderful. It's just an in and out. Remember, this is listener-supported Masonic education, so we can't do it without you. I do appreciate everybody who is assisting us with our monthly bills and allowing this podcast to grow, because you are supporting Masonic education. You know, we have more listeners to this program than there are Freemasons in the United States, fun fact. So we are spreading that Masonic light, and we're doing it all with your help. So I want to, again, thank every one of you out there who's helping us out. You're all amazing, and my gratitude goes out to you. Now, enough of this. Let's get into this awesome paper, then we'll hear from Steve Harrison, and then Joe Martinez, and we'll wrap it up for the week. All right, so this paper comes from the Illinois Lodge of Research, volume number 7, number 2, page 101, titled Ancient Mystery Religions and Freemasonry by Harold J. Spellman, J.D. The mystery religions have been interpreted by many writers as having been the ancestor of Freemasonry and therefore Freemasonry directly descended from such religions. This is generally referred to as the quote-unquote wisdom school approach. Their intimation is that the Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans had the equivalent of Masonic lodges. On the other hand, many modern writers seemingly take a singular or pragmatic approach to the history of Freemasonry, having held that the ancient mystery religions are not relevant to the beginning of Freemasonry, holding that Freemasonry arose strictly out of the events establishing the Grand Lodge of London in 1717, taking their cue from the guilds of the past. It is the view of the writer of this paper that both the pragmatic approach and the wisdom school approach are not mutually exclusive, and a balanced or harmonious view of the historical antecedent should be taken, and that this balanced view will be an approach taken in this paper, showing the connection between the mystery religions of ancient times and modern Freemasonry. Myths of Man. All of man's institutions developed out of or from one another. No institution ever sprang up full bloom without an antecedent, and so it is with the mystery religions. This antecedent started when the mind of man was first awakening. The first thing he began to question was acts of nature, the storms, the cold, the rain, and the floods. Having no pragmatic explanation for these natural phenomena, man developed myths to answer questions. These pre-literal stories dealt with supernatural beings or heroes that served as primordial types and a primitive explanation of nature and the world. Of interest concerning these myths was the fact that common myths are found in primitive cultures and tribes and societies that are great distances from each other and have had no contact with one another. This has led the famous Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung to conclude that mankind has a common subconscious from which these myths arose, given to man by a religious or non-religious source. We, however, as Freemasons, must conclude that they came from a religious source. Gradually, as time passed, man connected these myths with objective, observable heroes, men who had lived among them and had done heroic or supernatural feats. When a myth is attached to an individual person, it becomes a legend. Long after the individual has been forgotten, the legend will continue and oftentimes will pass into the realm of becoming a god. As Manly Hall writes, quote, "In order to make simple the great truths of nature, the abstract principles of natural law, the vital forces of the universe were personified, becoming the gods and goddesses of the ancient mythologies." End quote. One of the more common and, for our thesis, more important myth stories identifying with nature is the birth, death, and rebirth. This myth is found in almost all the Mid-Eastern prehistoric cultures and was passed from there to the Greek and Roman cultures. In one of its most popular forms, it is known as the Tomes myth. There are many variations of the story, but the essential features are as follows. A certain goddess came down to earth. In her wandering, she came across mortal man, whom she falls in love with. The human impregnates her, and she becomes with child. For one reason or another, the human was killed and descended into the nether region. In her grief as goddess, she descends into that realm to look for him. There she met with various adventures in attempting to have her lover return to the surface world. During her wanderings, the earth in sorrow over her going below became cold and barren and nothing flourished. She was finally able to make a deal with the god of the underworld, which usually followed the theme that the husband may live with her, the goddess above ground, but since the god of the underworld had fallen in love with the goddess, she must return and spend 6 months with him in the underworld. Upon the goddess and her lover returning to the earth's surface, the world rejoiced in seeing them. The sun reappears and the earth blooms. The husband is then killed. A son is born. He impregnates the mother goddess. He descends through some accident to the netherland. The goddess again goes below to rescue him. The earth again turns cold and is fruitless. Again a bargain is struck, and the two return to the surface with the same result. The earth blooms. The story repeats itself ad nauseam. This is, of course, primitive man's attempt to rationalize the change in the seasons, the disappearance of the sun, the onset of winter, and the failure of the earth to bloom. The goddess has gone below. This story gives him confidence to know that spring will return in due time, the earth would bloom, and life would go on. It is important to know this resurrection story, as it will, in a changed form, becomes the basis of the mystery religion, and many of the religions of man. By taking the myths of the season, with it raising in spring from the depths of the earth and applying it to the soul of man and the return of the soul from whence it came, rather than to agriculture, the mystery religions were born. It is one of the great discoveries in self-understanding, and forms the basis of Plato's philosophy and of Neoplatonism. Before examining these mystery religions, it is necessary that we examine the conditions in the Greek and Roman state religions during this period. Greece and Roman state religions. For our studies, the official state religions of both Greece and Rome provided the same challenges. The gods that they recognized were superhumans, subject to the same vices and weaknesses as man, but their strengths were also superhuman. They were relegated to a quote-unquote home, Mount Olympus, for instance, far from the life and world of men, and they took not the least interest in human affairs. There was no personal salvation, and the prayers that were addressed to these gods were never personal, but were always for the public good. The city-state regime was a regime where no wedge could be driven between the temporal and the spiritual foundation. The religion lacked both dogma and scripture. The ceremonies were pastoral and agrarian. The religion was totally indifferent to ethical conducts. One of the chief responsibilities of religion is to switch the response system of adolescence from the dependency of the child world to the responsibility of the adult world. This is a result not easy to achieve. The religions of Greece and Rome failed in this respect. In addition, the official religions provided no plans for salvation, no hope for eternal peace was provided. More importantly, the gods were immoral or amoral, and provided no code of conduct whereby one generation could pass on to the next a mode of right behavior. The gods, as we said, were only invoked for the benefit of the state, and then only when the state had a social virus, such as war or a natural crisis, such as a catastrophe. In summary, the official state religion of Greece and Rome failed to provide the two essentials of personal religion, salvation, and a moral code. As a result, the void left by the Greek religion to answer the needs of man, the Greek poetry of tragedy was born. The spirit of inquiry meets the spirit of poetry of tragedy. Tragedy was the natural joiner of the Greek world's love of beauty and its inquiring mind, always asking the question, why? What is this tragedy that will eventually lead us to the mysteries? A poetic tragedy shows us the greatest pain which a man can suffer and gives to us. From that pain, pleasure and insight. The change comes through the alchemy of poetry. Again, we turn to Edith Hamilton, who says, quote, "It is by our power to suffer above all that we are of more value than the sparrow. Endow them with a greater or as great a potential of pain, and our foremost place in the world would no longer be undisputed." End quote. So, tragedy is the suffering of the soul that can suffer and yet pursue its goal and eventually be victorious. In order to illustrate these tragedies, the poet's heroes turn to mythology, for nothing will ruin tragedy as will reality. In addition to tragedy, one other source of knowledge came to the aid of the people of Greece in lieu of religion to help them understand the place of man in the cosmos. This was Greek philosophy. By lessons learned in the Mideast, Pythagoras and Plato began to formulate the nature of the cosmos and the place of man within it through the use of mathematics, geometry, and the doctrine of the soul. As a result of the failure of the state religion to answer for morality and salvation, the Greek poetry of tragedy, the Greek philosophy of Pythagoras and Plato, the Greek ability to apply syncretism, the tendency to identify deities and combine them into a separate and distinct cult or religion, was applied, and slowly, the poetry of tragedy and the philosophy of Pythagoras and Plato united with the ancient mystery religions, and the new mystery religions began to develop. Even though the poetry of tragedy and the philosophies brought some comfort to the people of Greece, there was still missing two important ingredients of religion, a moral code and a plan of salvation. To supply these missing factors, the mystery religions were developed. They, as do all religions, grew out of a need. If man is not given what he needs to answer the age-old questions of death, society, and nature, he will invent his own answers. He must be able to know that somehow, as an individual, he fits into the scheme of things. All of this led the men of Greece to believe that the cosmos were created and laid down by God, teaching the unity of life with the unity of God. The Mystery Religions. During the history of Egypt, Greece, and Rome, there were hundreds of mystery religions. We know, for instance, that the famous school of Pythagoras, Cratona, was operated in the form of a mystery school. Its exact teachings, other than being formed on a conceptual mathematical basis, are unknown, Pythagoras having left, to our knowledge, no writings. We do know that most of it, if not all, the mystery religions were based on purification, processions, passions, plays, sacred symbols, and mystic liturgies. The only knowledge we really have of them comes from various poets, playwrights, and the early Christian church doctors who quoted them, rightly or wrongly, and we do not know much to refute their teachings and hold them heretical. We do know that the mystery religions were united in their search for knowledge and religion. They seemingly were first imported from the Near East, possibly Egypt, during the prehistoric period. They attempted to lessen the distance between man and God and forge bonds of unity between them. This gave the candidate a feeling of regeneration and redemption and made him secure against the trials of life. Through initiation, the candidate was united with God. A blissful afterlife was promised, and a triumph over death was guaranteed. What was the basis for this? Upon what philosophy was this built? We can only speculate. To do this, we will take the three most popular mysteries, all of which occurred in Greece, and examine them. Then, by projecting back into history, we may be able to get a feel for them and what they stood for. The three were known as the Dionysian, Orphic, and Eleusinian. The Dionysian Rites. Dionysus was a god of Thracian origin and was an offshoot of the fertility cults of the Mideast. These fertility cults arose out of the agricultural cults and myths used to explain the seasons. They carried the agricultural myths a step further by believing that the earth must be fertilized by blood, semen, or penis before it would again bloom. The symbology of planting an ear of corn endwise into the ground was a symbolic carryover from these rites and led to the corn rites practiced by many early Native Americans. The rites of Dionysians were an ecstatic form of sacramentalism. They took place in secluded places and were accompanied by wild drinking and dancing. The eating of raw flesh from an animal connected with Dionysus, torn apart by participants, ended the rites. All this emotionalism led to a state of divine intoxication. The members thought that they were at one with Bacchus, Lord of the Vine, a form taken by Dionysus, lifting them by this intoxication from the realm of reality to the unification with God, and in his realm, the intoxication removing them from reality. This wildness of these proceedings caused criticism and hostility among the more staid citizens, but it was a counter-reaction to the non-personal aloofness of the state religion of Greece. The Orphic Mysteries. The wildness of the Dionysians and the mysteries there led to the Orphic Mysteries, with its focus on aesthetics rather than orgiastic rites. The Orphic myth developed as a separate myth, and while it bore resemblance to the vegetation myths, it is endemic only to this mystery. It is an important antecedent as far as our studies are concerned. The myth, as related by Ninian Smart in his book, The Religious Experiences of Mankind, is as follows. Quote, Dionysius, under the name of Zagreus, was the offspring of Persephone and Zeus. His father wished to rule the world but had not reckoned with the Titans, a race of giant gods. They killed the infant Zagreus and ate his flesh. In his wrath, Zeus sent down a thunderbolt which burned up the Titans and reduced them to ashes. The human race was then formed from these ashes. Thus man is a combination of good and evil. He is evil because his substance derives from that of the Titans. He is good because his substance includes
through the eating of the infant god, that of Zagreus. But Zagreus was not dead, after all. Athena had managed to rescue the heart of the child, and Zeus had swallowed it. Zagreus was reborn as the son of the earth goddess Semele. Because of this, there was hope of a purified life for men through union with the once-living god. It remained for Plato to take this to its conclusive step and form the mystery religion that would prepare the way for Christianity and become the most important to our studies. Plato. The Orphic mysteries are particularly important to us as Freemasons, since Pythagoras was deeply influenced by the mysteries, especially those of the Orphic cult, and they were part of his teachings. The Pythagorean philosophy was largely based on numbers. He believed that the cosmos operated according to the principles of harmony, and this was proven by the numerical basis of music, music being the essence of harmony. This number philosophy was based on geometry, and geometry was the secret of understanding the cosmos and the order in the world. It explained the harmony that kept the world from self-destruction and was the basis of reality. Understanding the fundamentals of geometry would explain the things of the invisible world, the mysteries, the knowledge of the invisible world would be a liberating force for mankind. Plato took this one step further. He took the vegetation myths, the cyclical death and rebirth of the seasons, and applied them to the Orphic teachings, which said men are both good and bad, and the Pythagorean philosophy came to the conclusion that the soul of man is imprisoned in the body. It is this soul that is good and the body that is bad. Upon death of the man, the body returns to the divine power. The body is a sepulcher for the soul, and the soul is punished through union with the body. Man should control the body by controlling his passions, thereby freeing the soul to do its good. Plato asks, how may the soul be delivered from the illusion of sense, the distempering influence of the body, and the disturbances of passion of the body, preventing its vision of the real, the good, and the true? The answer, by philosophy, which he regarded as the great intellectual discipline for the purification of the soul. Morality commences with the soul. In the ancient mysteries, Plato's indebtedness and belief in the ancient mysteries is confirmed in his book, Phaedo, when he says, quote, "Those who instituted the mysteries for us appear to have intimated that whosoever shall arrive in Hades unpurified shall be in kind, but he who arrives there purified and initiated shall dwell with the gods. For there are many bearers of the wand of Thyrus, but few who will be inspired." End quote. The wand of Thyrus he referred to was a stalk of the Thyrus bush or tree carried by the initiate during the mystery initiations. The whole purpose of the mystery religion was to lead the initiate back to the perfection from which we first made our descent, the perfection of the soul before it entered the body. The Eleusinian Mysteries. The Orphic Mystery. Because of this influence upon Plato and of its promise of immortality as a reward for moral righteousness, seemed to be the basis for the third of our mysteries, the Eleusinian. The concern for morality and the way for immortality was the basis of this mystery. The refinement of the vegetation myth was also used in the Eleusinian mystery. The mythology behind the mystery, according to Smart, is as follows. Quote, "The daughter of Demeter, Cor, was carried off by Hades, god of the underworld. The sorrowing mother searched for her everywhere with a lighted torch. After various wanderings, the goddess came to Eleusis, on the coast of Attica. In her despair, she produced a draft, so terrible that the gods persuaded Zeus to have Cor return to her mother. Hermes was sent to the underworld, and Hades gave up his captive. By the trick of offering her a pomegranate, which symbolized marriage, Hades ensured that she would have to return. But Zeus effected a compromise. Cor would have to dwell within the underworld one-third of the year." End quote. Again, the death and raising of vegetation, the seasons are transformed into the death and raising of a soul, man's immortality. This transformation of the myth from vegetation season to the soul of man and the teachings that by following the moral lessons of the mystery school, the soul would have a better life in the next rebirth cycle. And by continuing to follow these moral teachings in each subsequent embodiment of the soul would finally be freed from the body and would remain in eternal bliss with the Creator. This was the heart of the Eleusinian mysteries and would change religion forever. The initiation was divided into two parts or degrees, and being of a secret and unwritten nature, we know little of the actual workings. We do, however, know something of its content. Some of this knowledge has been obtained from Plato in his Comments, but most of our knowledge comes from the early church doctors who described some of the initiation ceremonies for the purpose of proving that it was heretical and contrary to the Christian teachings. The Lesser Mystery. The first part, or degree, was termed the Lesser Mystery and signifies the misery of the soul while it is subjected to the body. This was accomplished in a procession from Athens at night, and a night-long fast. That there was an explanation by way of lectures and a drama tying in the vegetation myth with morality and the soul cannot be doubted. The great point to be learned from this first step is that it was an initiation or beginning. Quote, "The aim of all initiatic religions is the same the world over and has always been to guide men from the natural state of consciousness, which is called illusion or sleep, to a higher state called illumination, or the kingdom. The higher state was a destiny and a birthright, and is within a context of the natural world, quote-unquote, unnatural. It is the start of learning some great truth or moral teaching. In the mysteries, it is generally believed that the candidate impersonated the god to whom the mystery was dedicated in all his sufferings, and his death and descent into the underworld. This suffering and descent was always tied into the main point, that being the soul inhabited the body, and the soul constantly yearned to return, freed from the body, to its beginnings. Thus the candidate learned that there would be a unity of life within God, and that this was part of the orderliness of the cosmos. Again, morality and freedom from the passions of the body was the secret to this unification. The Lesser Mysteries were held in March at Agrae, a suburb of Athens. Men, women, and even slaves were eligible to join the mystery. The more important part of the initiation ceremony, however, was the greater mystery. The greater mystery. As we know, often a great period of time passed before the candidate was allowed to proceed to the greater mystery, in some cases as long as 7 years, for he had to prove he understood the lessons of the lesser mysteries, and in accordance therewith had led a moral life. As with the other mysteries, we have no direct knowledge of the form of the initiation and which it took. Our knowledge, limited as it is, comes from secondary sources, as did the others. We do know that symbology was important in the conferring of the greater mystery. An ancient Orphic verse reads, quote, "A wheel, a pine nut, and a wonton plays, which move and bend the limbs in various ways. With these, the Hespian golden fruit combine, which beauteous nymphs defend of voice divine." End quote. While this verse sets forth symbols pertaining to the Orphic mysteries, it is a fair certainty that these symbols, or some similar to them, would have appeared in the Eleusinian mysteries, since these symbols are much the same throughout the history of humanity. While they may vary slightly due to the social and economic influence of the times, their general spirit remains the same. Thus, this verse sets out 4 symbols, the wheel, the pine nut, the bending of the limbs, and the golden apple. Their symbolism appears to be as follows. The wheel is a symbol of the soul, the intellect, and symbolizes its going forth from the creator of all to the matter and its coming back to the creator. It also represents the Egyptian-Greek idea that all history and nature is cyclical, not linear, and that everything repeats over time. The pine nut from this conical shape is a symbol of spiritual illumination proceeding from its source, the point, to its broad base, the material nature. The meaning of the bending of the limb is at this time unknown to us. The golden apple is the pure, incorruptible nature of the intellect, the idea that gold never rusts and is pure. In addition to these symbols, there was a fleece of wool, it being a pun on the name of fleece of wool, which is the same in Greek as the name of a wine press, and has the hidden meaning of the pressing of the grapes, turning them into the vat of juice, alluding that all is one. We are all part of one cosmic origination, blended together, a mirror which is a double meaning of reflection of the god and introspection, and finally, an ankle bone, which signifies the going forth into matter. The initiatory rite of the greater mysteries ran for 9 days and began on the 13th of September at Athens. Before the ceremonies began, the sacred relics were brought to Athens by priests and priestesses and were deposited below in the Acropolis. On the 14th, the actual ceremonies started. The candidates were washed and ceremoniously sprinkled with pig's blood. The initiates were then led through passageways, where they were met with dramatic presentations of grief and vengeful demons, diseases, old age, fear, and want, evil goddesses of persuasion, poverty, war, and always, death. Empedocles calls this the quote-unquote material abode, where slaughter, rage, and countless ills abide, end quote. These were often portrayed by demons. Death was often portrayed, but without the actual physical dying. The message, as we have said, is always the same, that man is not as he should be, that within him is contained the divine spark, and that his life should be a quest to rekindle that spark. These ceremonies were conducted at night to symbolize the soul's descent into the darkness of the material world. All of this requires the struggle of man against his own nature and the ultimate death of that part of his nature which prevents the divine from shining through. These journeys were but the symbols of the quote-unquote experiences we must undergo in the building of excellence of character. It is necessary that the candidate die, symbolically, to kill the material, the body hindrance. These journeys and the ensuing death were most dramatically portrayed, sometimes to the point of realism so dramatic that the candidate was in an actual danger of losing his life. Some examples are being buried alive or put to sea without provisions in a small boat. However symbolic death was done, the candidate was raised from the corruption of the body and its passions by some form of dramatic presentation, and that by the five senses, light, music, touch, hearing, and smelling, brought to the candidate a feeling of having his whole being raised to a higher plane. This was an emotional feeling to be felt rather than to be explained. He was then brought face to face with God, bringing to the candidate the idea that he had, by shedding the demons, the demands of the body and its corruptions, been united with God. This was done by elaborate staging, worthy of the most technical advancements of today. Thomas Taylor, in his Eleusinian and Bacchic Mysteries, states that complicated forms of magic were used which produced psychological changes in the initiate. Whatever the method, we know, the candidate was greatly impressed, and the mysteries were very popular in Greece and other places in the ancient world. After raising and facing God, the initiate was given instructions to the future rewards and punishments based on the knowledge imparted. These lectures were much the same as the moral messages found in early Christianity. The gist of the message was that the misery which the soul endures during its life in the body, when the body follows a life of irrationality, is the beginning of or the same torment which the soul will then have to endure in the afterlife, although then it will be much more dreadful. These thoughts are much the same as have been carried over into Christianity and can be compared with Milton's Paradise Lost. The candidate also receives lectures on how to live in accordance with the lessons of the mystery. There can be no doubt that it was an emotional and moving ceremony. It was personal and brought the candidate in direct contact and forged a direct relationship with his God, something the state religion had failed to do. The importance of the mystery religions to Freemasonry. Blue Lodge. The quote-unquote official findings of Freemasonry today is that the ancient mystery religions have no bearing either as a precedent or in the teachings of Freemasonry. This is a position which this paper attempts to refute. The reasons for this official position are many and have been fed by leading Masonic journals, such as the Ars Cortor Coronatum, whose editorial policy is to refuse to publish anything of a spiritual nature. This is due to the current belief that the history of Freemasonry, as well as other branches of human knowledge, are only subject to the scientific method, and only pragmatic and scientific evidentiary facts may be used in the research into such history. The error in this thinking is that Freemasonry, as is religion, is not subject to pragmatic facts only. Freemasonry and its history is based much on the esoteric, the knowledge from within, instead of the exoteric, the knowledge from without. Witness the third degree. This is often due to the fact that it is often difficult, without an in-depth knowledge of what is meant by the spiritual side of Freemasonry, to distinguish the difference between the true spiritual teachings and the writings of the New Age. It is also a product of our scientific age and the limits it proposes. But we should not blame our scholars. We as students and readers have not been taught to realize that there is another theory to the history of mankind and the cosmos than being a cyclical, non-linear explanation of our past. This cyclical theory is well known and is correctly receiving long-delayed attention by advanced scholars in the fields of history and nuclear physics. Therefore, it is the intention of this paper to show that there is a relationship between the mystery religions and Freemasonry. This relationship does not consist of lodges and an organization of Freemasons along the lines of our present fraternal organization. Far from it, but this paper does claim that there is a relationship between what is presently taught in Freemasonry and what was taught over 2,000 years ago. It must be kept in mind that at the time of the formation of Freemasonry as we know it, the organization of the Grand Lodge in 1717, there was a tremendous revival of interests in the cultures of Egypt, Greece, and Rome. The people were particularly interested in the symbolism of ancient Egypt and the mystery religions. There was a high interest in deism during this period, and the ancient mysteries must have had a great influence on the unknown writer of the third degree. Dr. de Saglier? Perhaps. There is great similarity in the teachings of the mystery religions and Freemasonry, both using the initiatic process to convey their lessons. This process, as we have seen, commences with the cleansing ceremony. The initiatic process throughout all history teaches that man is destined to be more than he is, that within him there lies the spark of the creator of the cosmos. In Freemasonry, this spark is referred to as the grand architect of the universe. This godlike part of man, claims Plato, is his soul. This too is taught in Freemasonry in the ritual of a life hereafter, one of the two beliefs that a Mason must hold in order to be a member. Both Freemasonry and the mystery religions hold that during the life of man, this soul is vexed, being in the body, and yearns to return from whence it came. That the soul, being imprisoned in the body, is unable to properly exercise the godly function, being under the control of the body's passions. It is only by leading a pure life, through the teachings of Freemasonry, the ancient mystery religions, by the subduing of the passions, that man is capable of allowing the soul to perform its earthly functions. This initiatic teaching and the method of teaching forms the basic similarity between the ancient mysteries and Freemasonry. The first part of all initiatic ceremonies is the cleansing and has been applied to the Christian faith in the symbol of baptism. This is symbolically done in our first degree, where the candidate is divested of all medals and is dressed in white and asked the question, is he worthy and well qualified? As we have seen, this was a major part of the lesser mysteries and, at times, took long periods of time for the candidate to prove his worthiness. The second degree teaches the candidate that by studying the liberal arts and sciences and uniting them through the understanding of the principles of philosophy and geometry, the ways of the grand architect of the universe may be understood, since the cosmos is created and operates by these principles. This is, of course, pure Pythagoreanism, and was, as we have seen, a moving force in the mystery religions. It also forms the basis of Freemasonry as set forth in the Fellowcraft degree and the claiming of Pythagoras as a brother. The third degree, as did the mystery religions, portrays the death of the body and the transformation. This death and transformation is an essential part of all mystery religions, and only they have such a form of initiation. It is only this initiatic process that links us with the teachings of Pythagoras, Plato, and the mystery religions. Most, if not all, our brethren recognize that, quote-unquote, there is something to this Masonry, but are unable to say what it is. It is the failure to distinguish for them and for ourselves this key found in the initiatic process that beclouds the real meaning of Freemasonry. It is true that the mystery of our craft cannot be taught, but we can see that those willing to understand are exposed to these mysteries. Scottish Rite Masonry. There is a second debt owed to the mystery religions that is exemplified in the higher degrees of the ancient accepted Scottish Rite. The degrees of this body, an exemplification of the basic truths found in the Blue Lodge degrees, are taught by means of a drama, the same method used to impress the candidate of truths in the greater mystery religions. This was done by a dramatic presentation using all the techniques of the theater that were available at the time to impress emotionally the truths there presented by music, lightning, darkness, and many other stage techniques. Ancient Accepted Scottish Rite presents its degrees in this manner. In the beginning, Scottish Rite did not present its degrees as drama. They were presented as lodge degrees. It was not until the very late 19th or even 20th century that the Rite switched its format to a dramatic presentation. Your author has an incompletely researched theory as to the reason for this change, and here presents it as a hypothesis. During this period, the late 19th, early 20th century, there was a revival in things of an Egyptian nature in our culture due to the scientific explorations of ancient Egyptian ruins. At this time, there also appeared in our popular science magazines, Scientific American, for example, many articles on stage magic, such as colored smoke, lighting, techniques, improved scenery, presentations, and many others. The then leaders of the Scottish Rite determined to portray these degrees in a manner of the ancient mysteries, using many of these newfound techniques. In addition, they were receiving competition from the York Rite and its most popular Knight Templar degree, which was done in a lodge setting. George Warvel, an early leader of the Scottish Rite Valley of Chicago, has written, quote-unquote, the occult sciences, the mythic, and Eleusinian mysteries all contributed to the general scheme and were held to be a part of the great arcana of Freemasonry, end quote. All this leads to the conclusion that the mystery religions should be recognized, as should their techniques, as having much to contribute to Freemasonry and its roots and philosophy. All right, I hope you enjoyed that paper. You know, I said I would give my reactions to the paper, and I guess it kind of underwhelmed. You know, we've covered a lot of this before, and what's stated is a really good explanation of the facts. I wholeheartedly agree that these mystery religions likely came from Egypt. Perhaps Egypt has them from even earlier sources, antediluvian. I'm not going to presume to know. But the evidence does suggest that, you know, we have human bones that are dated to 60,000 years ago in the present Homo sapiens sapiens. So the upright walking human as we are today, DNA is identical, well, nearly identical. And we have upright walking hominids just like today, 60,000 years ago. This is way before Egypt. So perhaps there was some mystery religion that Egypt took, and then, of course, by way of conquering and the typical cultural appropriations that happen when these things occur, the mysteries move through Greece, through Rome, and end up as Mithras, and later on we see the Christianization of the Mithraic religions where we have the Roman legions becoming Saul Invictus. And even later on, in Cults of Mithras, we see Jesus depicted as a Roman legion. And with this, it's a call to the deification of man. It's really interesting stuff. And yeah, Freemasonry literally is the modern version of what's happening within these degree systems. Of course, we cannot take the road to Eleusis and drug you all day and then take you into a temple by fire and scare the crap out of you and change your life forever. But what can we do by the legal standards of the gentlemanly society that we have? So Freemasonry in that regard is 100% the adaptation of, in my opinion, what was practiced 2,000 plus years ago. I digress. Let's get in to illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison's Masonic Minute.
Latin is a dead language. Dead as dead can be. First, Latin killed the Romans. Now, it's killing me. There were times I felt as if that little ditty was my anthem during the 4 years of Latin I took in high school. Latin? 4 years? Why? I had my reasons. Beyond openly exhibiting the fact that I was a pathological masochist. Even back then, however, I knew, and others did not hesitate to point out, I was studying a language no one had spoken for centuries. Impractical, they said. Maybe so, if I was looking for a functional language, but not if I was interested in the Roman history that went along with studying the language. Not if I wanted to study a language that formed the basis of many others and led to a better understanding of English. Besides, when I took my college entrance exam, I tested out of all language requirements. Take that, ye naysayers. Still, I would never have advocated Latin should be a required subject. To some, it was and remains unnecessary, irrelevant, maybe even useless. Today, many high schools don't even offer it as an elective. I think that's unfortunate, but I guess it's a sign of our times and school budgets. So now, it seems a new subject is the target of those who think it's unnecessary, irrelevant, or maybe even useless. Call it cursive, longhand, script, or in my case, scribble. Irrelevant, they say again. We are all typists. Make that keyboarders. As they toss it into the junk heap of forgotten subjects, along with music, art, and God knows what else. Maybe Freemasonry. Lots of people think that's archaic, too. This, too, I think is unfortunate. There's something to be said for studying subjects beyond the three R's, to broaden our cultural backgrounds. But I understand. We must be practical. I recently spent the bulk of a year transcribing the Masonic memoirs of Frederick L. Billen, a 19th century Grand Secretary in Missouri. Written in fading longhand, this was a difficult task, but well within my capability, and probably yours, given the fact that schools didn't ditch cursive before our time. As I went through this exercise, I realized in years to come, what I was doing would be a specialized skill. Without its use being universal, I can see cursive becoming a prerequisite for someone wanting to study history, as long as history doesn't fall off the educational cliff, too. Those founding fathers didn't use keyboards. I suppose I could be an old fogey and lament the passing of another useless subject, but I might as well accept it and take heart in the fact that I have a new old skill. I am a cursive specialist. Maybe it also needs a little ditty, something that goes like this. Cursive is a useless thing. I've other skills to hone. They should have written the Bill of Rights on an Android or iPhone. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, huge thanks goes out to illustrious Brother Harrison for his always great work with the Masonic Minute. Make sure you check us out on YouTube where you can download those videos and watch the show, make your favorites, create playlists, all those great things. Again, go to youtube.com. Subscribe to the Whence Came You channel, WCY podcast channel, and by doing that, you increase our likelihood that, of course, we are moving into a viral direction so that we can spread this philosophy to the masses, right? We always say, people ask, is Freemasonry even relevant today? And regardless of some of the pessimism that we sometimes put out there, including myself, I think the overwhelming answer, of course, is people say, yes, Freemasonry is needed more now than ever before. And if you believe that, then Hey, shameless, right? Like and subscribe to the podcast channel. By doing that, your friends see, the algorithm shows, it says, hey, you might like this, your friend likes this, blah, 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 right? We know how this works. So spread that philosophy, help us out. Also, by getting to a certain number there on YouTube, we are able to access studio space in certain cities across America. And I travel so much for the fraternity, going from state to state and around the country doing Masonic lectures and things and getting to share some amazing fellowship with all my brothers out there, that maybe while we're out there, we can do something cool at a studio or interview somebody in another state and do some things that we otherwise might not be able to do. So help us out. Like, share the videos, like the videos. Make sure you subscribe to the channel. And, of course, share them on Facebook, social media, Twitter, all those good things. Now, let's talk to Brother Joe Martinez from Manassas, Virginia, about Esotericon. All right, guys, I'm super excited. I have a close friend and brother, Brother Joe Martinez, has joined us for this episode. And we've got him on to talk a little bit about the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon for 2019. You've heard him talk about it, and we've had a little ad playing on the podcast for the last few weeks, and I thought it would be a great idea to have him come on and talk a little bit about what spawned the idea, and in general, what his interest in esoterics is, why he tried to put something together like this, and to market it in such a broad way across essentially worldwide. So, first of all, Brother Joe, thanks for coming on the show.
Brother Robert, thank you so much for having me. This is an absolute pleasure, and I think I mentioned it to you before. I apologize in advance if I geek out a little bit, but I've been a super big fan of you for years, and again, a close friend, but I'm going to internally geek out a little bit as we have this conversation.
Well, you know, it's mutual. You guys, Joe's been pretty amazing and inspiring as far as what he's been doing and bringing back Masonry in his particular neck of the woods where he's from, but this is just one extra step in that, so... Joe, you guys might know, did an episode of the Masonic Roundtable with us a few weeks ago, and he discussed the symbology and the history of the Holy Royal Arch High Priest garments, which was absolutely fascinating as somebody who studies a lot of the mythos as it relates to the building of the temple and the religion as it were in that day. So fantastic job on that. Let me ask you a little bit. So first of all, when is the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon?
So the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon will be held on June 15th, 2019. That's the day of the actual conference. The day before, the 14th, we're having a brew night for folks that were lucky enough to get a ticket early enough, but that's since sold out. And then on June 16th, we are having a private tour of the House of the Temple. So the Esotericon is the entire weekend, but the actual conference itself with our speakers and our guests and our vendors will be on June 15th from 9 a.m. until whenever it finishes.
That's fantastic. I love that you guys didn't actually put like a finish time. So many times we're like, oh, we got to cut it short, you know, and then somebody gets cut off. There's like 1,000 people that are like, but I wanted to hear the end of, you know, some crazy cool lecture.
Well, strangely enough, we went through our first choices of speakers that we wanted for this very first Esotericon, and we had no idea, and I've told you this before, how popular it was going to be so quickly. But our first slate of speakers, we totally expected one or two or three or more to drop out or say they weren't available. But as it would have it, every single person said yes. So we hadn't planned on 8 speakers for the very first one, but that's what we're getting, since every single one of them were excited to come out and join us at the Esotericon. So you're getting 8 speakers. So it should be a good long day.
It's fantastic. You know, when you look at the list of speakers, you typically have a lot of the guys who make the rounds. And so a lot of the time I'll go to a conference and whether I'm speaking or not, like I'm always there to listen to the other speakers, like Masonicon last year, 2 years ago, at Ezekiel Bates, I went and I listened to Pierce Vaughn. I was so excited to listen to what he had. I got to listen to our good friend Greg Kaminsky, and I was like, man, this is, you know, I was fanboying out for these guys, and it was so cool. And it doesn't disappoint. These guys don't do, like, the speakers you have for Esotericon are not dudes who are always out there doing stuff. They are, for the most part, very select in what they want to do. And so, like John I know he loves data, but he loves mysticism, specifically Christian mysticism and things that go along with Rosicrucianism and a lot of that stuff. And so I was excited that he's going to have an outlet to do something. You've also got Greg Kaminsky, as I mentioned, Pierce Vaughn, but a real gem, you've got Don McAndrews coming out, and I've never seen Jamie Paul Lamb do something. So if you don't know, Jamie Paul Lamb did Myth, Magic, Masonry, a wonderful book, probably one of the most technical and well-written Masonic textbooks relating in the realm of, I don't want to say fringe, but the esoteric realm of Freemasonry. And you got P.D. Newman. So how awesome is that?
So strangely enough, P.D. Newman was the one who actually referred Jamie Lamb to us. We invited P.D., and he was like, you know who would be great for something like this? You need to reach out to Jamie. And I did, and he was so excited to be a part of it. And then I bought his book the next day, completely blown away. I think you sold that book absolutely perfectly, but it definitely touches on some really interesting stuff. And he's going to touch on little bits of his book at the talk, you know, just to give everybody a little taste. And I actually just talked to him a couple of days ago. He's coming. He's bringing a bunch of books to sell and to sign as well. And I think a lot of the published folks that are on this list will be bringing, you know, some of their wares to discuss and sign and talk to the brethren about.
That's fantastic. Let me ask you, we've talked before, and you've been a Mason for a long time. You've said you kind of got into Masonic podcasts and a lot of what's going on in terms of a renaissance or of Freemasonry kind of in the electronic space has pushed you to jump back in with both feet. But, like, what got you thinking to do an esoteric, a strict esoteric conference?
Well, I think, just to be clear, I was not the only father of this. There's a couple other hosts, Kevin Homan, who I think you've met before, and two people that everybody here knows, John Ruark and Jason Richards. They're also helping us out. But Kevin and I have been doing most of the organizing and logistics and things like that. And we're all Virginia Masons, and we all know each other from lodges and visiting around and things like that. And the primary reason that we decided to do this was coming back from the last Masonicon. We came back, we felt invigorated, we felt really excited about Masonry, and you know, Masonicon showed us some of the best things that could happen in Freemasonry when you have a bunch of people that are dedicated and want to put the time into bringing you things that everybody wants to hear about and know about and talk about. And we, the four of us, just decided to, hey, let's have a conference in this area. It's the DC metro area. There are a ton of Masons here. We talked to lots of Masons that are interested in esoterics and philosophy and, you know, some of your more fringe topics. So, yeah, so we decided to, the four of us decided to, let's put on a conference in this area, you know, in the D.C. area, and see if it would spark any interest. And so we decided to have it out in Northern Virginia. We could have had it in D.C. or we could have had it in Maryland, but we wanted to do it in Northern Virginia because it's a little less expensive than making people fly out to D.C. and stay in D.C. And, you know, we had better pickings on where we could have a venue. So we picked my home lodge, the NASA Lodge, and we just put it out there and tried to see what kind of interest it would generate. And I mean, from day one, people started emailing and saying, hey, I'm really interested. Who's coming out? And we were like, holy crap, I guess we could better put together a program. So we hit up all those speakers. You saw that first list. There were seven. And then, you know, PD recommended Jamie. And after emailing with him for 5 minutes, I knew he absolutely had to come. And then we started talking to people about it and advertising it. And the interest came so fast and so furiously that we were like, man, we need to really start putting this together and make it a decent event. And I mean, you're talking to, I mean, John and Jason, they had put together the 300 celebration, so they did have some experience in this, but Kevin and I had never done this before. So we definitely tried a lot of things and just saw what stuck. And I mean, it's growing to be a really amazing experience. I mean, we're 2 months away, but I think it's going to be a fantastic event. And people are already asking for the next one. So we're going to have to, you know, up our game a little bit for subsequent esotericons.
Yeah. So I was talking with Ben Wallace about 3 or 4 months back, and he and I guess he's going to be the Grand Master. They're coming to Esotericon, the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon. They're really excited to come out. And I think they want to kind of broach the topic of the Middle Chamber program, which is like a Grand Lodge sanctioned esoteric course of study. So to have that kind of buy-in, and those guys are flying up from North Carolina to come to the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon as well, I mean, man, yeah, you guys really put something special together. You should be really proud of it.
Well, we have 2 months before I'd say I'm proud of it, and I just hope to God that it goes well. But to that point, I think you did a show on the Middle Chamber program, right?
We may have talked about it, yeah.
Yeah, and I was actually doing a reading on that. That sounds absolutely amazing. I'm already planning my retirement home in North Carolina, so I can go party with those guys. But to your point, we hit it off, and you know this, we hit it off with the guys at Ezekiel Bates.
Yep.
So well that worshipful Brian Simmons, he was super helpful, helping us get set up for Esotericon and giving us tips. So big shout out to him. A bunch of the Ezekiel Bates guys are coming down. They're taking a road trip and they're going to be hanging out at Esotericon as well. So
man,
it's going to be a really eclectic and awesome group of people that are going to be hanging out with us that weekend.
I don't know who I'm going to hang out with. I'm just going to hang out next to you and. Like,
Everybody. Yeah. We're just going to have a big circle. And
it's so perfect. Yeah.
Yes.
If you guys are interested, I know you got to be interested. We're going to have the show notes that'll take you direct to the Eventbrite page where you can buy your ticket. The tickets are only going to be on sale, I think, for another week. So if you're listening to this on Sunday night, if you're a super nerd, or Monday morning, usually when folks listen to this, maybe on the way to work, you've only got a few days left to buy a ticket. So go into the show notes. You're going to click on it. You can go to eventbrite.com, and then it's the 2019-Mid-Atlantic-Esotericon-Tickets, followed by this ridiculous number. But we're going to get you a hot link there that you'll just click. You can also find it on Facebook. So if you go on Facebook and you search for the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon, it's going to pop right up. You're going to see it. And there's a link there for tickets, too. Brother Joe, did I leave anything out? What do you have as far as... I know we're sold out on the brewery night, right? So that's Friday night. We're sold out. You've got tickets left for the actual event. And then for the tours, that's limited to the first 50 people who bought tickets who say they want to go.
That's exactly right. So we have... So brew night sold out. We're actually going to talk to the folks at Sinistral. The name of the place is Sinistral Brewing Company. It's in Old Town Manassas. It's right by the railroad tracks. Very cool hangout. And they were super happy about, you know, getting a big group of folks to basically take over their establishment. So that's going to be really fun. There's going to be food trucks there, two or three different food trucks throughout the evening, pulling up and serving food. And we don't know exactly which ones they are yet, but they'll let us know in a couple of weeks. And then the actual conference itself, we still have tickets. We are nearing capacity, so we're going to have to put the kibosh on the ticket sales very, very soon. So I just blasted the Facebook universe with updates on until we run out of tickets or April 26th, whichever comes first. There's a limited window. There really are a few tickets left because the response has been much larger than we anticipated originally. And then the last thing you mentioned, the House of the Temple tour, we're going to have a private tour of the House of the Temple on Sunday morning, not too early. But it'll be a private tour. We're going to get to see some cool things that the general public does not get to see. And like you said, that's limited to 50. We do have a few more tickets for that than we do for the actual conference itself. But, yeah, everything you said is perfect. Thank you so much for that tiny URL link because people did not like the link we had originally. So I appreciate that. If you go to Facebook.com and search for Mid-Atlantic Esotericon or go directly to MA Esotericon. It'll take you to our event page with all the individual events. They're listed there, hotel information, information about the brew night, the House of the Temple tour, and then the individual speakers and their what presentations they're doing.
Yeah, I guess the last thing I would mention to everybody out there is that, so as somebody who went to the San Diego Comic-Con every year I lived in California, so for several years, and then even flew back 2 years in a row after I moved to the Illinois area or Chicagoland area, I always thought, like, how cool these cons can get with multiple events and speakers, and how amazing it would be if we did something like this in Masonry. And finally now, we're at a place where these are happening, and they're amazing, and we've got, of course, MasonicCon and Ezekiel Bates. They're like the granddaddy who decided to actually do something amazing. Nothing against other lodges, right? But these little open houses or whatever, those are cool. But when you put together something with multiple speakers and events and like a brew night and you do the whole thing, it's something really special I think a lot of people get into, and it affects us in a way that is, hey, this is life. We can also have fun with this, expand our minds and geek out on all this cool stuff. And now we've got an esoteric venue. This is going to be perfect. So I'm really excited. I can't tell you how proud I am to, you know, have Joe as a friend and a brother, and to be coming out and helping support this first Mid-Atlantic Esotericon. It's going to be amazeballs. So,
well, I think you just, yeah, I mean, you hit it on the head, and before you asked the question of why, and you actually just answered that question, is there is a need for this and there is a want for this, and people are not getting it. You know, you may get it in drips and drabs. You know, I don't get it at a lot of lodges I go to. You know me. You've known me for a while. I'm a joiner. I like to join things. I join a lot of things. There's probably more things I've joined than my wife knows about, so she will not be listening to this episode. But I like to join because I love learning new things. And I can tell you most of the things I've joined, Appendant Bodies and other groups, things like that. The big problem is it sounds great on paper, but not a lot, you know, meat and potatoes. You know, there's substance that could be there and you just don't get it, right? Because people have to read minutes and there's a lot of business to take care of and light bulbs to change and things like that. So you don't get a lot of that experience in the places you're supposed to. So that's the primary reason why we put this together, is because there's brothers and people who want to know more about this and want to learn and want to discuss, and they don't have an out for it. So we're giving them that outlet, you know, as opposed to forcing our lodges or forcing our appendant bodies to turn a certain way. We just said, we're just going to do it on our own, and everybody who wants to come play can come play, and we'll all have a good time together. We won't rock the boat. We won't upset people, and we won't do things that they don't want to do. So this is for the folks that want to be there. And the way it's looking right now, there's a good chunk of people that want to be there. So,
well, I think it says a lot when you've got essentially the grandmaster of another lodge who assists in an esoteric program. You've got Ezekiel Bates guys coming down. The list of speakers all believe in what you're doing. So congrats again. And again, everybody out there, click that link. Get your ticket now, because if you're listening to this on Monday, you have 5 days before those ticket sales are gone. So get it done. Thanks so much for coming on the program, Joe. I can't thank you enough for taking some time.
Thank you so much. This has been a blast. Thank you for the 10,000 years that you've been doing this, and I hope you are on the line for another 10,000 more. So keep up the good work. Yeah, and you make me proud.
Thank you, brother. All right, one more huge thanks goes out to Brother Joe Martinez for his tireless work within the fraternity. Masonicon and Ezekiel Bates later this week. I'll see you all there. I'll have a couple of things for you guys to pick up if you're interested. Some pins, maybe some stuff from Skull and Crown. We'll see. Maybe some books, all that good stuff. But Joe Martinez should be there. I think he might be coming to Camp Masonry also. And we've got some other exclusive things coming up and some crazy announcements coming up over the next couple weeks also. So make sure you're coming back week after week and listening to your favorite Masonic podcast here. So with all of that, I went this whole episode and I didn't say it. Happy Easter, guys. Happy Easter. If you celebrate, I hope you are spiritually fulfilled and find yourself rejuvenated for the coming year and ready for spring. And I wish you all a pleasant year ahead as we look forward to springtime, again, rebirth, a time for new beginnings. With that, I wish you all an amazing week. Thank you for joining me on this 391st episode of the Whence Came You podcast. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.